Welcome to the Caving Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Pelser, of the Central Indiana Grotto of the National Speleological Society. And this is episode, well, it's technically episode two, but really it's episode one. This is how this show is going to go. It's going to be me talking to cavers. And actually, now that I think about it, one of the guests that I wanted to have on, and I really hope that I still can, is another member, a longtime member of the Central Indiana Grotto, Bob Van Deventer. And just before the National Convention in Nevada this year, he was climbing a mountain in Colorado, and he had a stroke. He is a tremendous guy, super nice guy. He's the keeper of the Central Indiana Grotto Library. He holds open library nights every month. He's a big caver and he's a big outdoor guy, and he had a stroke on the mountain. He made it. But he's got some enormous medical bills. He's got about 50 grand that he needs to raise. And there's a GoFundMe that I have contributed to, that a lot of our grotto friends have contributed to. But even though a lot of friends have come and shown up for Bob, there's only, as I publish this, there's only about $2,000 in the GoFundMe account, a goal of $50,000. So if you can find it in your wallet and in your heart to help out a fellow caver who is just a tremendous guy, and if you've ever met Bob, you know that he is, see if you can spare a few bucks. Go to, I'm going to give you the web address, but it's kind of hard to remember. Really, you can probably just search GoFundMe and Bob Van Deventer. Here, I'll tell you how to spell his last name, and I'll also give you the web address for the GoFundMe. It's Bob, B-O-B, of course, Van Deventer, V-A-N-D-E-V-E-N-T-E-R. And the GoFundMe URL is GoFundMe.com/2EFZGB8. Again, GoFundMe.com/2EFZGB8. But that's a nightmare to remember. So go ahead and just Google GoFundMe and Bob Van Deventer, and kick a couple bucks his way so he can get well again and maybe even come on the Caving Podcast. Well, we have a great inaugural guest in Ron Adams. He is a member of the Central Indiana Grotto. He's been a member of the Grotto for over 30 years now, and he has just been everywhere. He has been, well, we'll get into that in a second. First, I want to talk about something that is happening with our Grotto very, very soon. Just after I publish this, we are having our Cave Capers. Now, so really, statistically, you're probably hearing this after it's already over with. But it is a tremendous, tremendous time every year. You know, people talk about going to TAG and CIRA and other cave festivals and, of course, the National Convention. We do Cave Capers every year, and we have for over 60 years. A lot of caves in southern Indiana, and you should really come out. If you missed it this year, make plans for next year. It's usually the first weekend in August. And so block that off on your calendar and come see what we've got to offer here in Indiana. Ron will be there, and he will be leading the music jam on Friday night, as he does every year at Cave Capers, and he's a tremendous guy. Say hi, because he'll say hi back and ask him some questions. You're about to hear me ask him a number of stupid questions, but to him there is no stupid question. That's what I love about Ron. He's very approachable. He's very knowledgeable. And he's been everywhere. He's been in Lechuguilla. He's been down to Mexico numerous times. He's been in almost every cave in Indiana. He's opened up some of the caves in Indiana. He's got an enormous body of work and tons of experience, and he is not one of those exclusive kind of cavers that doesn't want to share anything with you. He is happy to help you if you want it. And he's happy to say yes if you want to go on a trip, unless it's some serious, you know, survey project. He's just a great guy. And so let's check out episode one, two, with Ron Adams from the Central Indiana Grotto here on the Caving Podcast. How's it going, Ron Adams?
Doing well.
So, welcome to the Caving Podcast, episode number one.
Awesome.
Yeah. Thanks for making the time. I know that you're well known, and so I figured we'd start off with a big splash by having Ron Adams on the Caving Podcast. So, I guess we'll just start with when did you start? Like, when? What was your first trip? How old were you? And we'll just kind of start from the beginning.
I started caving when I was 19. I was in college at IUPUI, and I met some folks from Plainfield. And Plainfield is pretty close to the Buckner's caving area. And back then, it was standard for high school students at Plainfield High School to go caving. And so they introduced me to it and did a couple trips with my immediate friends. And they lost interest pretty quickly, but they introduced me to somebody else in their group of friends that was caving, Joe Oliphant. And so Joe and I hit it off and started caving together a lot.
So he's so you were the dynamic duo then, starting out, you and Joe.
I suppose we were independent.
Yeah.
You know, we weren't affiliated with any organizations. So we were just kind of coming up, learning on our own, finding equipment on our own.
Looking back, was there anything that you and Joe did that you would now consider like unsafe or irresponsible or anything like that? Or were you always pretty by the book? I mean, even though you didn't know what the book was.
Well, we had a couple of unsafe moments, but for the most part, we did things pretty safely.
So was Buckner your first caving experience then?
I went to Coon Cave in Monroe County, which is in that vicinity. That was my first cave. Buckner was actually my third cave trip that I did, Wild Cave.
So, okay, so you said 19. So did you locate caves based off of Doug Love's book or what? How did you find stuff? Was that it? Yeah.
That and, you know, my group of friends at the time knew of some of the caves in the Garrison Chapel Valley already. So there was some common knowledge, and then we started pursuing those books that you could get.
For those listening who don't know, Doug Love wrote a book that was kind of controversial called The Spelunker's Guide to the Garrison Chapel Valley. It had cave locations, and it was available like for free at the Monroe County like Tourism Bureau. So
I believe he had a couple other books.
He had a couple other ones too.
I think there was one for Washington County and maybe one for down in Lawrence County area.
But that did kind of jumpstart the caving careers for a lot of people, yourself included.
True.
So you got started, you tried it out on like what trip? Was it the first trip or a couple trips in? When did you like catch the bug and think, man, I want to keep doing this, like get serious about it?
Well, like it was fall 1981 when I got really interested, and that was my sophomore year of college. And that summer went by and I didn't really get outdoors at all. And that made me sad because as a kid, I used to do a lot of outdoor activities. And, you know, when I got to college and started living on my own, you know, I had to kind of find my way on what I wanted to do. And, I was no longer hanging out with my dad and doing stuff like I was before. So, I wanted to find some kind of activity, and caving seemed to involve hiking and camping and getting out in the woods. And so I just kind of took to it immediately and realized that was the outdoor activity I was looking for.
So before you started caving, you were into other stuff too, which is kind of the case with a lot of people who get into caving and then just kind of go full bore. Like what else were you into? You were into hiking. And
I did a lot of fishing, and I did a lot of walking fields looking for arrowheads, artifacts. And my dad kind of got me into that when I was a kid. So I spent a lot of time doing that. And even through my caving years, still did some of that.
What is it about caving, though, that really kind of satisfies you and keeps you coming back? I mean, is it just the weird alien environment? Or is it a combination of things like it is for so many people?
You know, I think there's several facets to why I like caving, you know, and this could be a really long conversation for me, but I think it starts.
That's why I brought you in.
It starts out with, I feel like caves make you feel like a speck in the universe. And it kind of, being in a cave gives you a feeling that you don't get in other aspects of our normal life, being around everything that's made by people all the time. And let's say, for instance, you're in a cave and you're looking at the cave wall and you're aware that the rock was formed at the bottom of oceans, you know, however many hundreds of thousands or millions of years ago. You know, they say the Earth is 4.5 billion years old, and I don't know the chart of geological time well enough to just rattle off the top of my head when when certain rock formations were formed or whatever. But so you're looking at the cave wall and you see a piece of coral that's fossilized, that's washed out of the limestone, and maybe some shells and stuff.
It's not something you see every day.
And you're looking at these shells thinking, well, that used to be alive, and then it got covered with all this rock, and then it got pushed up tectonically so that it was above the water table, and then it cracked, and then water and carbonic acid dissolved the cracks open big enough, and it just really, you know, like, I mean, you have to be aware of the processes that formed it to, you know, have a full image of what's going on, but it really makes you feel like a speck in the universe. And, you know, it just really blows my mind. I feel like caves are multidimensional in that respect. It's kind of like you can see the universe when you're in a cave.
Yeah. You kind of, the more you know about how it formed, the more you can appreciate little things like that. That's really cool. So you probably just went recreational caving with Joe and company a lot, just kind of crawling around and doing stuff. At what point was that not enough and you felt like you had to start discovering and surveying and stuff like that?
Well, Joe and I toured a lot of caves in southern Indiana and built up our strength to be able to do longer and harder trips. And, you know, at some point along the way, we started getting interested in the exploration side of it, although we were still very much amateurish about our pursuits of that in the beginning. And I went to my first grotto meeting in, I think it was 1982 at the CIG. And
at that point, you had been caving for just a little bit.
Right. And we heard about the grotto. And we went there and we got kind of a frosty reception.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is a common theme, you know.
Was it then like it was really exclusive at that time or something? Is that how you feel about it?
I think it boiled down to there were a lot of cavers who did exploration work and survey, and they would see some young guys, maybe a little on the wild looking side, come in and, you know, think, well, these guys are just, you know,
they're just thrill seekers.
Or, you know, it was kind of a shame that people weren't necessarily friendlier at the time. But I think the grotto went through a period of people would join and buy gear and then become disinterested quickly, or a lot of people would come through to the point where they kind of had too many people coming around. And I think there, you know, every activity has cliques of people that know circles of friends. And, you know, some people have to kind of force themselves to be open and friendly to people. It's not something that comes naturally to all folks. And cavers are kind of a unique faction of society with all types of personalities, you know, and you have like bookworm geology type people, and you have thrill seekers, and the myriad of personalities is great enough that, you know, there's nobody really in charge saying, well, you all need to be friendly, or you all need to be greeting people in a certain way. You know, it's something that you really have to think about. And it's something that now, as a grotto, we really try to make a point to be friendly to new people. You know, I go out of my way to talk to visitors. Any visitor I see, I introduce myself. I try to be friendly, thanking them back on my experiences, you know. So I don't necessarily blame people for not knowing exactly what to do, or, you know, because nobody's paying people at the grotto to do this stuff. And, you know, I think that we've, as a group, we've learned. And, you know, maybe in the future, our group will forget that, or, you know, so.
Well, as long as you're in our grotto, I don't think we'll have a problem. Because I mean, I can remember when I first joined Yeah, I mean, I knew like two people there. Two people. One, the one person who brought me in, and the one person I brought with me to the meeting. And you were quick to say hi, and a couple of the other guys. But yeah, I mean, some guys can be prickly, and I think that's just a personality thing. I mean, when meetings are big, like when somehow we'll get some kind of word out and then we'll have a bunch of people show up, how does that make you feel? I think for some of the guys, it makes them nervous when it's a big meeting, a bunch of people show up.
That's what I like. I like to see plenty of folks at a meeting. You know, thinking back to 35 years ago, the meetings were big. And the first meeting that I attended, there was a program being given by Noel Sloan, who has done a lot of international caving, and it was a slideshow on caving in Europe, and he had gone to some kind of international caving gathering in Europe and then went to several different countries and toured a bunch of classic caves, some of them were deep, pushing the limits of the technology at the time. And I was just blown away by his show. And that really impacted me.
Really kind of cemented the bug.
Yeah, and also just opened my eyes to the world of caving and just how, no pun intended, deep it can go, you know? And also, at a later time, I looked up Noel in the phone book and called him up, and he spent like an hour talking to me on the phone, you know? And so there's people out there that are open and friendly, you know, then and now, that will take you under their wing. And, you know, Noel's still a good friend of mine to this day. You know, I definitely got benefit, even though we were kind of turned off by the grotto in general. We still tried to make it to Cave Capers when we could, because that was a really good time. And I went to my first Cave Capers in 1982 at Stage Stop Campground.
Yeah, Cave Capers is a big thing that our grotto, the CIG, puts on every year about August. And yeah, in southern Indiana, we got a lot of cool caves. Let's talk about actual caves in southern Indiana that you've, and just everywhere that have really made an impact on you. I remember from a few minutes ago, you were talking about how you and Joe and friends would do harder and harder caves and try to build up your fitness level so you can do even tougher caves than that. Like, what were some of your favorite caves to kind of exercise in?
Well, kind of started out with Buckner's and doing a circle route in there, and got interested in going into Wayne's Lost Cave.
Wayne's is from my limited experience, I don't want to say it's a hardcore cave. Would you say Wayne is kind of a hardcore cave?
Sure.
Yeah.
I would say that as far as caves you can tour in Indiana, that it's challenging.
It's got a quarter mile crawl, which has some really tight spots.
And going to the end of that cave is a pretty challenging trip. It's probably a solid 8 hours if you're moving pretty good.
Would you say that, what was that, Camp 4?
Camp 4
Camp 4
is one of the farthest reaching spots.
So what do you deal with? I've never been back to Camp 4. I've been in Wayne, and I've done the RPI passage, which is a really, really decorated passage, but I've not been back to Camp 4. What was it about Wayne, aside from the crawlway, that kind of really conditioned you for tougher and tougher caves?
At the time I did it, it was the toughest cave I had been in. We were getting interested in going into Reeves Cave, which is another Monroe County cave that's very significant. And, you know, back then the access to these caves was pretty easy compared to nowadays.
Yeah, nowadays Wayne is gated and a lot of them are on private property with...
Yeah, Reeves is pretty much inaccessible now.
Is it really?
I think you can go there if you talk to the right folks and get the right circumstances, but it's difficult to arrange a trip there now.
Mm.
And we're interested in going to the back of Reeves Cave to look at possible continuations. And that was a very, very difficult trip. It was much harder than a Wayne's trip. And also, it was wet and you had to do a long water crawl.
Did you have wetsuits?
No.
You didn't do wetsuits?
No.
Yeah.
I just dressed with a lot of wool and, you know,
it
wasn't a great way to do it, but it worked.
Well, so, okay, you've told me this story before, but I want to reiterate it. So you did Wayne to condition yourself for Reeves Cave. You said you did Wayne how many times in 1 week?
We did a Saturday, then a Wednesday, then the next Saturday.
And it was the same?
And went to Camp 4 three times in a week to condition ourselves for a Reeves trip.
You said that's about an 8-hour trip, but you got it. I think you said you got it down to like 6 hours on the last
No,
day.
I think less than that.
Really?
Yeah.
Nice. You're moving.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was a fun trip. You know, it was just a fun challenge. And I think the Wednesday trip we did in the evening after work.
So did you do, oh gosh, after work. So you were probably out like way after midnight and did you have to work the next day?
Yeah.
Sore day the next day.
Yeah.
So when you got conditioned to do Reeves Cave and then you did Reeves, not to stay in the past or anything, but I'm just curious about this story. When you went in Reeves, did you get back to where you wanted to get to and did you find anything?
We did not find anything new. What inspired us to go in there was we were caving with Randy Jackson, and he had done a lot of exploration in Reeves Cave with Gare Connor, and he encouraged us to go back and push the end of these water crawls. I think well knowing that it would probably it'd be really grim, you know. And
how long was the crawl, the water crawl to get back there?
I think it's in the 1,000 feet range. And
so Wayne,
you're
kind of
floating
crawl.
Through it.
Oh my
but,
gosh.
But with airspace enough for your head, you had to like dip your ear some of the time.
Kind of ear dipper bathtub.
Yeah.
Good bit of the way. The Wayne crawl, there's a couple little wet spots. For the most part, though, it's dry.
I consider it dry.
Yeah, that's dry. Yeah. Man.
And Reeves has a pit in it. And at the time, we did not do rope work. It's about 30 feet.
Okay.
But it has even more exposure than that because at the bottom, it kind of goes down farther. And if you fell, you'd probably like hit and keep going, you know.
Ugh.
And, you know, this was when you asked earlier about dangerous things. That was definitely our most stupid, dangerous thing we did was using the cable ladder in there. We knew that the cable ladder was not in the greatest of shape.
It was in there. It was already in the cave. It was fixed in
yes.
there.
Yes.
Oh, man.
Yes. So we went to Walmart and bought a ski rope.
Okay.
And I tied loops in it so that you could, like, put your feet in the loops.
Yeah.
You know?
I've seen that.
And so we brought that back with us, and we got down the cable ladder okay and did the trip. And then on the way out, Joe climbed first, and he made it up the cable ladder. I was climbing second, and the pit is narrow, the bottom half of it, and then it kind of opens up wider. But where the ladder was hanging, it was narrow enough that, you know, you could feel the wall on both sides of you.
Yeah.
And so I'm climbing up through there, and the ladder broke.
Oh, God.
And I was able to just, like, expand myself.
Did it break from the top or where
wedge.
Your feet were?
It broke at a rusty spot. And when it, you know, like one side gave and then the other side gave and then it just fell down and I was able to wedge in the crack.
So what'd you do then?
And then I used the ski rope. Climb out.
Oh my gosh.
You know, and.
Well, that's a wake up call.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Jeez.
It was kind of a spiritual moment for me.
So when did you start, like discovering and surveying, because you've opened up a lot of caves in Indiana and elsewhere. When did you start getting super, super serious?
It really, meeting the right people was what made it happen for me.
What was your first like job on your first like survey trip? Were you just Sherpa and gear or what?
Dave Black taught me to survey. And he was very active in mapping a lot of caves in Harrison Crawford area. You know, he's probably mapped more caves there than anyone. I would say
there's a lot of caves
well,
there too.
I would say over 100 that he's mapped. I really have no idea how many he's mapped, but
wow.
You know, if you start looking through Cave Capers guidebooks, you'll see him on most of the maps in Harrison Crawford area.
Harrison Crawford's in southern Indiana, almost right by the Ohio River. Kind of in the, if you look at Indiana, it's kind of right in the middle almost.
It's a little west of Corydon, Indiana.
Yeah. Beautiful down there.
Yes, it is. It's one of my favorite areas of the state for caving. What, you know, and unfortunately it's been closed due to white nose syndrome, all the state owned caves.
Mm-hmm. A lot of state forests down there.
Yeah. And so I met Danny Dybul and Greg McNamara in the mid 80s. I would say I met Greg in late 83 or 84.
To this day, you guys are like the trio now.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And I had seen Greg at a Grotto meeting, and then I was in the stairway at the engineering technology building at IUPUI, and we passed each other. And I was like, hey, I know you. You're a caver. And then he saw me, like, working on my car in the parking lot. I was stranded one day. I was doing replacing a camshaft in the engine of my car in the parking lot. And so we became friends pretty quickly. And then I had been dabbling with vertical in 1983, was started off climbing with knots.
Mm-hmm.
And then my first pit was in Harrison Crawford area. Then I eventually started going down to Tag and doing some pits down there pretty quickly. In 1985, I did Bridge Day and did the 850-foot rappel off of the New River Gorge Bridge.
Oh, yeah.
And my first Tag cave was an Eversink pit, which is now SCCI-owned cave, the Southeastern Cave Conservancy.
Yeah.
So that all kind of prepared me to hook up with the Greg and Greg McNamara, Danny Dibel crew. And we started doing some ridge walks. I did my first ridge walk with them down in Tag, in which Tag stands for Tennessee, Alabama, Georgia.
Yeah.
Caving area, the border, the counties there, some of the deepest caves in the Eastern United States in that part of the country. And we did a 5-day Thanksgiving weekend ridge walk, and we set up a base camp on the mountain and then ridge walked from there. And we found some caves. And
nice.
So around that period is when I started hooking up with the pros and learned how to survey and explore and ridge walk and look for caves.
Well, so back then, I mean, nowadays I've been on one ridge walk with you. And so when you find stuff, you just mark it on your GPS. What did you do then? Did you just do it? Did you just, when you found a cave, you had gear on you and you just did it? Or did you have like a topo map and you put a little X or what?
Generally, we try to have gear because if you find something really exciting, you don't want to wait to go into it.
Exactly.
But also we ridge walk a certain time of year, you know, usually like in the winter, a lot of times February, March, when the leaves are down and you can see the land, you can see the holes, and it's really nice if it's really cold and
see
since
steam
the air movement in the
nice.
Caves, and you know if a hole is more significant by the amount of air that it's moving. So it kind of depends on your situation. Sometimes maybe you just, you know, back in the 80s, we didn't have GPS, so we just had topo maps and we're marking the holes we find. You know, sometimes we would ridge walk without gear and try to cover as much ground as we could, mark the holes, and come back to them later. Sometimes we would ridge walk with gear. It just kind of depended on the circumstance.
5 days. 5 days straight you were out there? You just camp on the mountain?
Yeah.
Man.
Yeah, it was awesome.
What would you say is your longest ridge walk you've ever done, just straight?
It's probably about that.
Probably about that.
That amount of time, yeah. I don't recall getting much more time than that, but I've done a lot of 4- and 5-day trips down to Tag. It's kind of nice to, if you're doing the traveling, and to be able to carve out that kind of a chunk of time. I still do generally 4-day ridge walks every year down the Tag.
What about actual in-cave trips? What's your longest?
My longest in-cave trip is 7-day trip in Lechuguilla Cave
in
Carlsbad National Park in New Mexico.
Let's talk about Lechuguilla. When was that? Have you been there just once?
No. I did a few trips in, I'd like to say, 1987.
Yeah.
I'm not sure the exact date.
That was just like a year after they kind of opened it up, right?
That was a couple years after.
Yeah.
And, you know, they had already mapped a significant portion. They'd already pushed it to being one of the deepest caves in the United States. And Joe Oliphant and I went out there, and we knew some Chicago guys who did several trips out there. Dan Lanini was our main contact that kind of helped us get out there on a Cave Research Foundation trip. And back then, at least at that period of the exploration, it was still pretty flexible. You could show up, and if you had a place you wanted to go in the cave, you could just do it. They weren't really assigning solid itineraries for everyone that showed up.
Huh.
And, you know, you had to have at least some experience in there to know where you're going. And so I did three trips in the week that I was there. And the first trip, we just went to the Chandelier Ballroom and kind of got familiarized with the cave. And then our second trip.
What was that like? I mean, just see something like that.
It's got to be one of the best caves in the world. It's definitely the most impressive cave I've ever been in my life. And, you know, it's rated as one of the top 10 mineral caves in the world. And so there's a lot of gypsum powder. And the gypsum is a byproduct of the solution, the dissolution of the limestone. And so, you know, there's a giant space, and then there's all this gypsum litter left behind from the cave being carved out. And it's a unique formation. I'm not going to know all the proper geological terms, but basically the carbonic acid in the air dissolves the cave instead of having water running in. It's like pools of water that have the acid coming into the air. And then also there's a lot of bacterial dissolution of the limestone. There's bacteria that actually eats it and keeps making the cave bigger.
Wow.
And so the cycle of various things creates a balance where the cave's growing without any running water. And, you know, it's in the bottom of a desert. So there's not that much water.
Yeah.
You know, the water is standing. It's not running. It's not flowing. It's a very unique environment, and that makes a lot of the gypsum stay in place. It's not getting washed away by a flowing water. It's just, you know, since it all happens without the water flow, then the byproducts of the chemical reactions remain in place.
So the walls and the floor are all, white. They're all pretty white, so it's easy to see in there.
Yeah, it is. A little bit of light goes a long ways, and everywhere you go, you have to be careful not to break stuff. You know, you're constantly on guard.
Man.
And also everything's sharp and wants to cut you. And it gets between your knee pads and your skin. And
it's hot in there too, so it's not like you can really cover yourself up.
Yes. You wear shorts and a
68
t-shirt
degrees in there, something like that?
Yeah, it varies. I think it's 68 to 72. The deeper you get in the cave, the warmer it gets because there's some thermal igneous heat type of,
man,
you know, underlying. And so that week I was there, the second trip I did, we went into the Western Borehole, and we did about a 24-hour trip, and Dan Lunini led that trip, and we went to some leads he had surveyed out there. And that's one of the most amazing trips I've ever been on, because you not only saw all the crystal formations, but then there was a lot of flowstone too. So there was like both types of environments, a lot of drip formed type of formations, you know, that were just outlandish. And, you know, there's books published on it, photo books and stuff. And those are really worthwhile to have because, it's just unique, amazing environment. And, so then the third trip, Dan and his crew had to leave, and that left Joe and I there with time to do one more trip. And we found somebody else there that would do a trip with us. And we decided we were going to go down and try to push the deep point of the cave. And
which at that point was where?
It's somewhere below the Chandelier graveyard area of the cave. And on my last trip there in 2009, we passed the leads going down. You know, the cave is laid out in a series of surveys. So we went to the field house and, you know, said, well, we want to go to the deep point. So they printed out a list of the surveys we had to follow to get down there. And their system was to mark the survey stations with flagging tape and markers. And so you would find the flags and look for the numbers you needed. And then most of the time it agreed with what was on the paper. But sometimes, like, people would survey and put a station down that was already used, and then they would have to change it. Like, you know, let's say you're in XYZ,
yeah,
and you start a new one and you say, well, I'm going to use XYX. And then you get out and you find out that somebody else used XYX, and then they have to change it. And then it doesn't agree once you get in there. And then big cave systems run into problems like that. They try to give you survey stations that haven't been used yet so that problem doesn't happen. But that's one of the things in navigating in a big cave is, like, what you have on your paper may not agree with what you find in the cave, and you have to work around that. So we had some issues like that, but we did eventually make it down to the deep point. And a famous caver, Pat Cambyses, who's a tiny girl.
She helped write the book, one of the books on Letchigia, Deep Secrets.
Yes.
Right? Yeah.
And we found that we couldn't fit through the spots that to get to the leads that were marked. We were able to find some leads down there, but we weren't able to push the actual deep point because we didn't fit.
Man.
But it was still an epic trip. I think we were in there for 40 hours, and we ended up just sleeping on a big sandbar, and it was 72 degrees down at the bottom, you know, and it was quite comfortable. But that was quite a trip. And, you know, so I got to do 3 trips in a week back then in the early days of the exploration of the cave. And I wasn't able to go back after that just because of the logistics of my life. I started my own company in 1992. It was kind of stuck to where I couldn't travel extensively for many years. So, but in 2009, our daughters started getting older and was easier to deal with. And I was having some time in the winter after the economy tanked in 2008. My winters were slow, so I decided I needed to start doing some traveling. And my buddy Andy Armstrong has been a major player in the exploration of Letchigia in the more recent, you know, in the last decade. And he invited me to do a trip in 2009 in December. So I went out and did a 7-day trip there, and we went to the camp that is near the Chandelier Ballroom. I think they call it the Chandelier Camp. And so every day we had to travel through the Chandelier Ballroom to go to our survey objective and then go back to camp that way. And
life's rough, huh?
Yeah. And it was a great trip. We surveyed about a half a mile of new cave, and we did about a half a mile of resurvey.
Man.
And I was actually responsible for finding most of the new stuff that we found, because we're doing resurvey, and that's when you can sometimes find stuff. Like, they would had errors in the survey, and we had to go fix them. And Peter Bosted, who's a renowned caver, was on our trip, and he created a program to search the database for errors. And he could narrow errors in the survey down to certain parts of the cave. And so, like, he had a list of errors that we're trying to chase down. And so you would get to a section of the cave where they suspected there was an error, and then start surveying and try to find the error. And so we're doing a resurvey, and I'm looking off to the side at everywhere. I'm trying to find unexplored leads. And, you know, the whole time that we're doing this. And that's how we ended up finding half a mile's worth of new stuff, was just by looking at stuff while we're doing resurvey.
Yeah. A lot of downtime.
Yeah, kind of.
Good,
I mean,
use of downtime.
Yeah. Like, the sketcher is generally slower than the rest of the guys. Although some of the resurvey, we didn't have to sketch. Some of it we did. Like, there were places where the reason we were resurveying was because the sketch was inadequate. So, and that's some of the other problems that you get into in a 100-plus-mile long cave that's been surveyed over a period of 30 years. You end up with errors that you have to deal with. You know, survey standards are something that can vary over a long-term project. And, you know, several projects have had issues with problems like that. And so, but that was a really neat thing about doing that, is that almost any crew that goes in there to fix errors will usually find some unexplored stuff. And the reason for that is that since the cave forms with these pools and with air dissolution, there's holes in the walls and the ceiling. I mean, there are so many holes that you just can't keep track of all of them. You know?
You look at the map of Letchigia, and it's like a bowl of spaghetti. I mean, it's just,
yes,
it's just, so this was 2009, you know, you had been caving for a really, really long time at that point. And, but I have heard that nowadays, I mean, that 2009 wasn't that long ago, but I've heard that Letchigia is, I mean, it's hard to get on a trip there.
Yes and no.
Yes and no. It's kind of like who you know and how much experience you got and what you can bring to the table.
Yeah, but a big part of getting on a trip there is your availability.
Yeah.
Well, I guess imagine, because nowadays you're pretty much committed to multiple days in the cave, right?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
It's going to be a week long trip basically.
Cause it's just, I mean, there's one entrance and it goes everywhere miles around.
Yes.
Yeah.
And they've changed some of the policies of exploration there because of the sensitivity of the cave, since there's no running water. You know, the pools can get contaminated very easily. The camps can spread contamination. So I think there's 5 designated camps approximately, and each camp has its own water source. And then the human waste has to be factored in.
Oof.
You know, and
burrito bags.
Yeah. So,
oh boy.
So the solid wastes are carried out and the liquid wastes are dumped in a designated spot at the end of each expedition.
Man.
And so for the reasons of the impact on the cave, they limit it. I believe there's 10 trips a year. I'm not, you know, don't quote me on that. And then towards the, like November or so, all trip leaders who want to do a trip have to submit a proposal for their trip with their objectives and the list of people for the whole next year. So if someone's interested in going, they could contact those trip leaders. You know, you'd have to do a little research to see who those people are. Some of it can just be figured out by reading the NSS news and the reports that are done on the cave. And then if you can be on standby, because almost every trip, since they're planned this far ahead, has cancellation, and you have to have the qualifications. You have to be able to do long trips, have the stamina, have the vertical skills to do a lot of rope work, because there's a lot of drops and there's a lot of rope traverses where you're switching from traverse line to traverse line over these big exposed areas. And so there's tons of vertical work, and then you have to be able to contribute in the way of surveying. And you know, you have to be experienced to go in a cave like that and survey. They're not going to teach you on the spot there how to do that stuff. So,
yeah.
So, you know, you have to have the qualifications, and then you have to have the availability to get out there. And so, you know, that right there blocks out tons of people, having the time, having the skills and the availability. And even if you, so if you can have all that in place, then you can get on a trip. You know, maybe even if you don't know these folks, if you've got the references that you have the skills, if you have a body of work you've done in the past where you can show that you have the skills, then it's not that bad. I mean, you can get in there.
So you had talked about a little bit about your professional life before, and I want to kind of go back to that real, real briefly, because I'm wondering if you chose your work life to kind of fit around your caving life.
Totally.
Yeah. So you're a commercial painter. You kind of, I mean, you don't really set your own hours, but I mean, it's an entrepreneurial kind of thing where you get jobs and you do them, and then you can also make sure that you got your weekends off. And like you said, nowadays your lull is in the wintertime, so you go to Mexico and stuff. So you pretty much chose that so that you could do caving.
Yes. I graduated from college in 1985 with a bachelor's in construction technology, and I never interviewed for a job because I didn't want to get a real job. And one of my friends was an avid rock climber, and he was doing some painting in the summers and had his own little company going. And he had a builder that wanted him to take over all of his painting work. So I joined forces with him, and we started a company. It was actually his company, and I worked for him, and we kind of set it up so that he could travel and go on climbing trips, and I would mind the store, and then I would travel and do caving trips, and he would mind the store.
Yeah.
And we had a couple other guys working with us, but we had a crew, and then in 1992, he decided to move to Florida and take up scuba diving instruction for a career, and he was having a kid and stuff, so I started my own business at that point and already had a good customer base built up. And so, you know, having my own business kind of helped me to have the flexibility I wanted in my life. You know, I mean, there were a period of many years where I was paying my dues and didn't have necessarily all the flexibility that I wanted. But as time has gone on, I've come to have a lot of flexibility.
Yeah.
So
that's important.
Yeah.
gosh, there's some, we've only got a few more minutes. There's so much I want to talk about, but, so you go to Mexico every year.
Yes.
Nowadays anyway. When did you start going to Mexico annually?
I did my first Mexico trip in 92, doing a bunch of the classic deep pits down there, and went back again in 1993. And then, you know, that was around the time that I was starting my business. So I quit traveling like that for several years, and, had a kid in 1998, and in 2010, after I went to Lechuguilla. So then the next year I decided, well, I'm just going to start going to Mexico now.
Yeah.
And so I've gone every winter since then in January.
Nice.
And
you're doing big work down there.
Yeah. We're mapping, I think we're averaging about 14 caves mapped and discovered, mapped and explored over the last several years.
Man.
And, so we're accomplishing some work, and we're kind of got our fingers on the edge of a big system that we haven't found a way into yet. So it's kind of exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What would you say up to this point is your proudest achievement in the world of discovery or just caving in general?
Well, one of my favorite caves, I found the hole down in Harrison Crawford. It's called Blue River Run Cave, and unfortunately it's been closed for a long time because of white nose syndrome, but it's a beautiful little 1,000-foot-long cave, and that's one of my favorite caves that I personally found. And, you know, our group spent like 6 weekends digging it open, or 6 days on various weekends, and, you know, going there and digging on the sinkhole. And back then, there was no law restricting you from doing that either. But nowadays, they at some point they came up with a memorandum saying that you couldn't do things like that in the state forest anymore. And that was, you know, that was probably late 80s when they did that. So I would say that's one of my favorite achievements. And then, my work in Fisher Ridge Cave down in Kentucky is another thing that I'm really proud of. I've mapped 6,000 some feet in there myself.
Wow.
And, participated in discovering, the cave in the next ridge over, like we kind of doubled the size of the cave. It is right now, it's the 9th longest cave in the world, I believe. The statistics change pretty quickly as more caves get explored, and some faster than others. And it's basically part of the Mammoth Cave system, you know, which is the longest cave in the world.
Is it hydrologically connect?
They come within 1/4 or 1/8 of a mile of each other.
Yeah. Wow. So there's gotta be something somewhere, right?
Yeah, my view is that Hart County is all Mammoth Cave, and it's just cut up into segments, you know, like I feel like that whole area is just one big cave, and it's all pieces of it. You know, technically you can say they're two different caves. Fisher Ridge is about 125 miles mapped right now, you know, right next, it's 1/8 of a mile from a 400 mile cave. Gosh. So they're the same cave. I mean, you can say they're not.
Same rock anyway.
Yeah. And, but it's really amazing. It was just down there a couple weeks ago, and it's awesome, big cave. So,
yeah. Is there still, a little bit of, politics surrounding some of the survey down there? I had read that there were like people across from I-65 who were saying, you know, this is the important one. And then people on the other side saying, this is the one we need to concentrate on, and they probably connect, but we don't want to play nice with each other. I mean, what's in your experience, what's going on with that?
Well, I would say that it's a little bit more, divisional than how you're describing it, because, you know, a group takes on the exploration of one cave, and then a different group may take on the exploration of a different cave. And then the Mammoth Cave itself is explored by the Cave Research Foundation. And that organization is very political as far as doing trips into Mammoth Cave. And it's not something where you can just call somebody up and say, hey, I'm going into the cave and I want to do this. And they say, okay, you know, it's more of an organized project, and they have various entrances that they use. And, you know, I can't say that I'm real familiar with the way they work, because I haven't participated in.
You've been over Fisher Ridge. Yeah.
Yeah. And, I helped dig one of the entrances and really paid my dues in the project. And so I have a key, and all I have to do is just say, hey guys, I'm going, and I can go. you know, and so the caving politics down there are pretty deep and wide, and there's a lot of different groups doing things, and a lot of them are pretty secretive. And so there's a lot of division. You know, Kentucky doesn't even have a solid database for their caves like Indiana or Tennessee or Alabama.
Interesting.
And there's people trying to form that, but then it's so divisional there that one group has a bunch of data and another group has a bunch of data, and they won't share it with each other.
Hmm.
So, you know, maybe someday there'll be more unity in the caving in Kentucky, but it's kind of always been like that.
What would it take, do you think, for those groups to come together? A miracle? Or do you think that they just need to get over it?
Well, I think it's probably just going to take some time for the faces to change and people to want to work together. There's a lot of elderly folks that, you know, the spirit of cave exploration is not that old, you know, like in the 50s and 60s, the caving equipment wasn't very good, and it was a lot more difficult to do extreme exploration back then. So really the birth of the major exploration was around that time, and you still have some people kind of held out from that era that are slowly getting too old to be active anymore. And I think as things progress, hopefully some more liberal views will prevail, and and the people will want some unity in, you know, managing all that. So,
well, great. Well, I think we covered enough for today. I'd love to have you back sometime.
I'm realizing that I can do this for hours.
I know, man. You got into the mood and we just couldn't quit, but time went by quick. I want to thank you very much for stopping by and being on the inaugural episode of this caving podcast. This is pretty much only going to be listened to by cavers, I think, but that's cool. And I'd love to go on a trip with you sometime, man.
Well, I'm very honored. Thank you very much for doing this. I think it's pretty cool.
There, how was that? Ron Adams, a wealth of knowledge and just a great guy. And I want to thank you for checking out the Caving Podcast. We've got more guests coming. This is a monthly podcast, and I've only got access to Central Indiana cavers for right now. But if you want to be on this show, or if you think that you know someone who would be great on this show, let me know. Send me an email. This is my personal email address, alpineproductions@gmail.com. All one word, alpineproductions@gmail.com. Thanks again for tuning in. Tuning in. It's a podcast. Hey, happy caving, safe caving. And until next time, kill nothing but time.